Welcome to Ripple Effect Podcast. I'm Kashal, and here with me is Elvira. We're the host of today's episode. We're producing this podcast today with Oti, Beichi, and Lina, a students group from Hanken School of Economics. The podcast is part of projects in the course Sustainable Organizing in Times of Crisis, where we are interviewing a change maker in the field to explore real-world sustainability solutions. In today's episode, we have the pleasure of speaking with Nick Steiner, an expert in ecological regeneration and water cycle restoration. Nick is currently working at Water Stories, an organization focused on restoring natural water cycles to revitalize ecosystems. He has years of experience in the field, and we're going to explore his journey, the projects he's working on, and how this vital work impacts both local and global communities.
Welcome to our podcast, Ripple Effect. Today we have a special guest here with us, Nick Steiner from Water Stories. Nick, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Let's start with an introduction. Nick, can you tell us a bit about yourself and your background, and what led you to work with Water Stories, and what are you currently focusing on there?
Yes, of course. I spent, I think, pretty much all my youth more or less outside in the woods. So I've always had a connection to nature, and I realized that maybe not everything is so great and we should do something about it to protect the environment, since it's the basis for our livelihoods. And then I got really deep into water while I was studying. That was in 2012. And with a group of friends, we built an organization called La Foundation to fundraise money for water development projects. So we thought, like, hey, many people around the world don't have access to clean drinking water and sanitation. We should do something about that. So we organized lots of cultural events all around the world to fundraise for those projects. And during that time, I already realized a little bit, it's like, it's great to have wells and to kind of provide access to clean drinking water, but we should probably go a little bit deeper. And it was also around that time that I discovered permaculture and kind of regenerative agriculture and all these kind of things. And so I wanted to dive a little bit deeper into it. And I studied in my bachelor, it was international business, but in my master, I did innovation and entrepreneurship. So I always thought, like, hey, let's use business as a force for good instead of a destructive force. And because I had discovered already kind of permaculture and this kind of stuff, I wanted to learn more about it and get my hands dirty. Because, yeah, as you might know, when you're studying all day and you're just talking about business and economics all day, you kind of miss getting your hands dirty and actually creating kind of real value in the real world, I would say. And so after studying, I moved to Tenerife on the Canary Islands. And there I was volunteering for a few years on different farms. So there I worked on various farms, was working there, getting my hands dirty, applying knowledge. And I did lots of courses. I read all the books I could find, podcasts, everything around regeneration, soil and water. And also because here in Tenerife, when I moved here, it only rained around 1 week every year. Like, that's all the water we got. And so I realized, hey, we need to do something about that. We need to use the water in a better way. And it was also kind of at that point that I wanted to get deeper into teaching, because there were lots of other volunteers and I started giving workshops and all these kind of things. And then in 2020, a friend of mine with whom I had built up the organization in our studies, he said, like, hey, I have an idea for an organization to support farmers and we want to support them in their transition to regenerative agriculture. So I thought, oh, great, education is probably important for that. I would love to join and help. And so we built that organization over a few years. And I was responsible for the whole educational side. And we built it to around 30 people, I think. And at that point, I realized my job was just office all the time. As you can imagine, when you're building an organization to 30 people, it was just Zoom calls and emails. And I missed the kind of active part. And lots of people asked me, like, hey, can you help me with water management on my farm or my land? And I didn't quite have the time because I was so busy with our startup. And so I left the startup and said, like, hey, I need to go full on into water. And since then, I'm working with lots of landowners all around the world with focus on Europe, But yeah, we're supporting people around the world with water management, so helping them build drought-resilient landscapes, helping them also with water catchment systems, filtration systems, also supporting against flooding, all these kind of things. And so that's what I'm doing sometimes alone, sometimes with my colleagues. And a big part of my learning was also from Zach Weiss and Water Stories. So I had done a course with Water Stories as well. And at some point, Zach wrote me a message and he was like, hey, can you imagine working for Water Stories as well? And I thought, well, I learned so much from Water Stories. I think it's time to give back. So I also joined Water Stories. And so now that's one of the things I'm doing, is working with Water Stories in the educational side. So also they're trying to reach as many people as possible around the world and teach them how to restore water cycles. So a bit of a longer story, but yeah, that gives a bit of an idea.
Sounds very interesting. So for those who may not be familiar with it, can you briefly explain what is meant by water cycle restoration?
Yes, absolutely. So some of you might have seen those graphics maybe in school or maybe in your time where you see basically a landscape. You have the ocean on one side, and then you see these kind of arrows going up from the ocean and onto the land. And that's kind of the water cycle we often imagine, is that water evaporates from the ocean and then over the land it comes down back as rain. And so many people think that's the water cycle. So it evaporates and then it rains down. But actually there's also the small water cycle, which is, I would say, almost more important in the large one, where we also have lots of vegetation, so plants, many trees and others, they transpire water back into the air. So through their leaves, they're basically similar to what we have when we're sweating. So they're kind of giving off moisture into the air that then rises up. It's combined with microscopic organisms and also some dust particles from the plants that goes up into the atmosphere, then forms clouds and rains back down. And so that forms a cycle where we basically have water going up in various ways, then it moves further inland, and then it rains back down. So it's a very kind of simplified way of what we have there. But this is kind of the water cycle. And so it goes, you know, from the ocean all the way inland, and then through groundwater and river, it comes back down. And we as humans, we have been really great at disrupting the cycle. So we have destroyed vegetation, we have built lots of concrete channels where water can't infiltrate, and we've just done everything to disrupt the cycle. And so in our work, we are working to kind of bring the cycle back, so to restore the water cycle. So, and this can have various ways. So it's a very broad work. So it involves everything from restoring ecosystems, getting biodiversity back, and just, yeah, we're doing our best to get back to a state where these natural cycles work, because they're so important for our livelihoods, for clean water availability, but also for the climate. And yeah, we're working on that on many fronts.
Thank you for the explanation. You said your work focuses on restoring natural water cycles to support ecological regeneration. So can you share a specific project where you've seen the most transformational impact and what made it so successful?
Yes, we've just started, or not just, but last year we started working on a farm in Cadiz in southern Spain. And so there it's a 500-hectare farm, which is quite big. And so there we started working to restore water cycles. And so what we did so far, as we spoke with the owner, Manuel, and he had some problems with the erosion in one part of the property where water was washing away the road and it made it difficult to access. And so in that part, we started working with the little terrace. So we moved the road a little bit, and now that road is capturing all that water and bringing it into a different spot where we will build a series of ponds and dams and all these kind of things to store that water. And the great thing is, while we were working there for the first time, as we just finished building the first terrace, we got a massive rainfall event. So we got, in I think half an hour, we got 25 millimeters. So that means 25 liters per square meter in half an hour. So that was quite a bit of water. And it just worked, and it all flowed exactly where we wanted and infiltrated. And it was just great to see that in a few days, you know, we could start this work. And now in the coming months, we're going to continue this with lots of other ponds and all these kind of features. And you can see how green the area is around that and what a difference you can make with a little bit of work. And it only takes one rain event. and you already see the results. And we've done that in various places. So it's always like you shape the soil a little bit, you seed some vegetation, you plant some trees, and then as it rains one time, you can already see the difference.
Wow, what a wonderful story. What's the most surprising benefit of restoring water cycles that people often overlook?
I think the most surprising one is actually the cooling effect. So when we think about it, I mean, it's kind of obvious. It's like, okay, when we build a pond or a different kind of urban feature, when it rains, we can store water. So this is great. Where it gets a little bit, I would say more interesting, but not so obvious, is also that way, that water that infiltrates into the soil moves in the soil for potentially years. So actually we're restoring the groundwater, which is also a little bit less known, but we're also refilling rivers and potential springs that are there. So there it gets even more kind of away from the classical, we build a dam and we store water. And the climatic impact for me is the biggest one, where when you have trees and other vegetation, because of the transpiration that I spoke about earlier, so the trees basically giving water up into the atmosphere, in that process, they're also taking up heat. So basically with that water, they're transpiring the heat. So the trees are sweating, they're bringing water further up into the atmosphere. And this cools the surrounding area. And for everyone to imagine it, on a really hot day, if you can choose between, you know, walking in a concrete city or walking in a forest, you will immediately imagine kind of the difference in cooling effect this forest has. And so by bringing water into the ground, the trees with their roots have much more water available to transpire and to kind of move this heat around and to have this natural kind of air conditioning effect. And so by bringing more water into the ground, the trees have much more water available to transpire, so they can cool much longer, they can keep their processes functioning. And as another benefit, it also prevents wildfires, because when the trees are really wet and have enough water, it's much harder for them to start burning. So quite a few things that come out of the work we're doing.
Yeah, thank you. That's very inspiring. You talk about the project you had last year, or you started last year, but are these projects always successful, or are there areas where it's impossible to restore the water cycle? Or could you mention some common challenges you face in the implementation projects and how you've overcome those?
Yeah, there's different types of challenges. So in some areas, the main challenge is just that there is not a lot of rain coming down. Which is, you know, of course a problem, but it's also great inspiration to do this kind of work. So I think one of the best examples is one by Niels Beckmann. He did it in Al Bayda, Saudi Arabia. They built a project where they wanted to regreen the area, and they did lots of earthworks and lots of preparation, and they had some irrigation for their plants there. But at some point they decided, okay, let's stop the irrigation. Let's see if natural processes can do this. And after that point, it didn't rain for 2 years. So not a single drop in 2 years, which was really, really tough. And so, of course, not all the trees made it. And they were thinking, hey, will this succeed? What can we do? But in the end, it rained and the system survived. And so now, actually, it's still getting greener every year. They're not working on it actively anymore, but when they're analyzing the data with like satellites and seeing, it's still getting greener every year. And so I think this is the big challenge, is like, okay, what if it doesn't rain long enough? Like, how can we still overcome that? And so the way to do it is really being selective in which kind of plants you work with, what kind of structures you build. And so it always depends on the location that you're in. But this is a great example of a big challenge, is when it really doesn't rain for that long. In other projects, we face a lot of challenges also when it comes to regulation, because many of the rules were made for kind of these traditional, kind of when you hear the word dam, you think maybe of a concrete structure that blocks a river, all these kind of things, but it's as far as you could get from the work that we're doing. where we're working more in valleys where you don't have a river that's flowing, but it's just when it rains, the water just goes down, it cuts these channels. And so we're working in these areas just with clay, so just the soil that we have available there. And it's benefiting greatly the areas below because the water moves into the ground, it moves slowly underground. But regulation is made for these more like destructive and kind of large construction projects. And so it's really difficult to get permissions to build these structures and to restore natural ecosystems, because in the eyes of many regulatory bodies, we're doing construction work. You know, and so many of these rules are made to not disturb natural ecosystems, but we're actually creating more life, we're creating more ecosystems, but we have to jump through the same hoops as, you know, big construction projects. And it sometimes makes it a really long process to get all the permits and to really get the work done. And yeah, then of course, it's always also people. You know, you have projects where you have many people who need to make the decisions, and maybe one is really on board, the others are not. And so sometimes it can just take really long to get the decisions made. And yeah, then also funding, you know, it's always a thing where it's like motivation is there, but maybe the money isn't quite there. And yeah, there's lots of different challenges. But what we found to work best is that we work with decentralized smaller systems. So instead of just trying to build one massive pond or lake or something, we just build lots of smaller decentralized little pond systems, terraces, all these kind of things. Because that way it's much easier to say like, hey, let's build one or two, let's see how they function. And if they perform well, we can build more. And so that way we can get people excited. And generally people really like this approach because it's much cheaper from the beginning. We can get going kind of tomorrow instead of waiting years to get the permits. And yeah, I think that way is really, really great. Small stuff, experimentation, and then just seeing what works.
Great. So you mentioned earlier that you're living in Canary Islands. So yes. You're in Tenerife. As I have understood correctly, there is a lot of drought is severe. So are there any special things you need to consider when doing water restoration project in areas with low rainfall, like the Canary Island?
Yeah, especially for us here at home. I like a good challenge, and so this place is no other. So we're living fully off grid. So we have only solar panels for electricity and water. We only have our roof. So we don't even have a well. So other places, you know, you might have your water connection from the city, or you might at least have a well. And for us, we only have the roof. So if it doesn't rain at all, we're completely screwed. And normally here we get around 280 millimeters of rain every year. So that's 80 liters per square meter per year. But last year we were in a severe drought and we only got around 80 millimeters in 12 months. So in the whole year, which is really nothing, you know, in parts of Northern Europe that could easily fall within one day. And that's what we got in the whole year. And it made it really challenging. And especially for me, like I would love to plant lots of trees, but also a veggie garden and all these kind of things in the garden. But I can't, because I know now everything is kind of green because it's the rainy season, but usually after April it just stops raining, and then sometimes we don't get any rain until September, October. And so we have to choose. It's like, okay, do we want to be able to wash our plates in August, or do we want one avocado tree more? You know, so this is kind of the decisions we have to make, and it's really tricky. Whereas if we get a normal year of rainfall, I've designed everything now that we have enough storage to get to it. But yeah, over the last years, we've been in a drought and we don't have enough water stored to get through that time, which makes it really challenging. And so in these situations, we really need to be careful about what we plan for. So everything is designed in a way that it can handle large rain events. And if it rains enough, we can store everything. But we can't just go out there and plant whatever we want, because you need the first few years of irrigation to get things off the ground, and the water is just not there. And so it depends on the project. You know, some have a different source of water and they can subsidize kind of with city water, and there we can work differently. But here you basically need to design in a way that it might not get any water for months, and then it still has to function. And when it rains, we might get tropical storms that sometimes come over the Atlantic. And then the system also needs to be able to handle these. So the spillways, the overflows, all the safety features need to be big enough to handle that. Yeah, so it's definitely much easier to work in areas where it rains all the time. But yeah, also those areas don't need the work as much as these dry places.
Yeah, thank you for that. So I think it's evident that you had a long experience in water cycle restoration. So have you seen a change in farmers' attitudes towards the restoration in recent years? And what about the shift in attitude in general?
Yeah, I think there is a big change happening over the last few years. When I first moved here in 2017, I started speaking about water kind of a bit more frequently and openly. And I said, like, hey, water is super important, especially in agriculture and in all these areas. We need to focus more on water. People were like, yeah, I don't know, maybe. I don't know, let's do carbon stuff. It's more exciting, more important. And as the weather patterns kept changing and got more extreme, people are realizing that water is so important. So what we're seeing a lot now is longer droughts. So we have longer periods without any rain, and then heavy rain events that often lead to flooding. And we're seeing these all over the place now, all around the world. So when we were working on a project in Marbella in southern Spain a few months ago, while we were there, a massive rain event hit Malaga as well, so close by, and we saw kind of the destruction that is caused by this rain event. And so it was great that we were there and we could document and we could motivate there where we were working to work more on this. And I feel like the general public is realizing that water events are getting more extreme. And I think there it's also important that we adjust our kind of language, because we often just speak of climate change as this ominous thing that's happening. And in many people's minds, climate change is equal with, okay, it's just carbon dioxide related. So it's just about how much carbon dioxide we have in the atmosphere. And that's kind of moving the needle. But what I think people need to realize, and what people are realizing luckily, is that maybe climate change is also much more related to how we use our land and how water cycles are disrupted. And there, especially on LinkedIn, a few years ago, there were Alpha Law and me, we were kind of the only people speaking about water. And now LinkedIn is full of people saying, hey, water cycles are important. We need to work on water cycle restoration, which is fantastic to see. Like, okay, there is a change. There is a change happening. People are realizing it's important. But I still feel like it's still too slow. So many people get excited about it, but are not so excited to spend money on it yet. But I mean, that's how things start. And as these extremes will get more and more, we will also see much more kind of finance move into this, because yeah, it's so much cheaper to build landscapes that can handle these extremes than to repair the damage that is caused every year.
So you mentioned it's very slow. So for the listeners who want to get involved in water cycle restoration efforts, what are some simple first steps they can take in their own communities, for example, to make a tangible difference?
I think the great thing nowadays is the internet, and there's so much available online to learn. And that's also a big part of what we're doing with Water Stories. So on Water Stories on our website, waterstories.com, and also with the community, we have countless free resources, but also on YouTube. So also that's where I'm working a lot on social media to provide a lot of free content. And so that's what I would recommend everyone, is like, find kind of people who are teaching, find the free resources that you can get. And that way you can get a little bit of an introduction to, like, okay, what works, what can I do? And then it's all about experimenting. And I'm not sure how it is with other people, but for me as a child, I played a lot in the sandbox. And, you know, building little channels and then pouring some water into it and seeing how it flows. At least in my childhood, that was a very common thing. And I can recommend that to people, to just do much more of that. Because if you play now, kind of, also it's great to get away from the computer you know, and playing around in the dirt a little bit and seeing like, okay, when it rains, where does water flow? So observing just outside, is the water just going down into a drain, or is the water going somewhere where we don't want it? Maybe some people have some plants in the garden and water is not getting to them. And then just with a shovel, making a little, like few little changes to get water more towards the places where we want it and less towards the places where we don't want it. And from that, you can learn more, you can build some models. And yeah, I think that's the easiest, like just go out with a shovel when it rains, see how water behaves and see what you can do about it.
Thank you for your tips, very, very great tips. Nick, thank you so much for sharing your incredible insight with us today. It's inspiring to hear about the impact of water cycle restoration, and I'm sure our listeners are motivated to take action in their own communities. And before we close, is there anything else you'd like to share with our audience? And also, where can listeners find and follow your work?
Yes, first of all, thanks so much for having me, and I think it's super important for all of us to learn a bit more. Yeah, as a motivation, I would just invite everyone to think a little bit about what water plays in their lives. I guess all of us need to drink water, which is the first one, but just think about how much water you're using on a daily basis. Think a bit more about where that water comes from and what you can do about that. So if you have, you know, access to a roof, could you capture some rainwater? Could you maybe infiltrate some of that water into the ground? Do you know someone who has some land and could benefit from this? And so it's basically just starting to ask questions and not just taking it for granted that water comes out of the tap. I think that's a great starting point. And yeah, if people want to learn water stories, definitely if you Google water stories, you should find us. But waterstories.com is kind of the teaching site. But also I'm very active on social. So Permanik is my handle there. So if you look for Permanik Water, you will definitely find me on LinkedIn also. And there I'm always happy to share and all that. And yeah, if some of you maybe know people who are struggling a lot with any kind of water projects or want to improve them, always feel free to reach out and we can see if we can help there.
Great. Thank you, Nick, again. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. And we hope today's conversation inspired you to learn more about the importance of water cycle restoration and take steps toward creating a more sustainable world. Thank you.